Tomorrow, Hillary Clinton is scheduled to deliver what her campaign is calling a major foreign policy address in San Diego. Clinton's advisors are hoping foreign policy will be an area where she can attract some voters who are concerned about Donald Trump. Our next guest has played a key role in U.S. foreign policy for decades. George Mitchell is a former Democratic senator from Maine. He was Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He was also a special envoy to Northern Ireland and the Middle East. His memoir, The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, is out in paperback this week. I spoke with Mitchell last August and asked him, as a negotiator, what would get Democrats and Republicans in Washington to work together?
Well, I'm not a political scientist, but I do think there are some things that could be changed that would help change the atmosphere. Before I describe them, let me say that you have to keep in mind that politics has always been rough in American history. There's never been a time when it's been all sweetness and light and everybody buddy-buddy working together. Yeah. Go back to the presidential election of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams, brutal allegations on both sides, a very tough campaign. But what makes this current situation different and more difficult to resolve is the ubiquitous nature of electronic communications, in particular television, the use of negative advertising, and the vast sums of money that are needed in campaigns for that purpose, and the absolute overwhelming tide of money that is now in American politics in the billions, billions, and billions of dollars, and so corrupting our society. And when I say corrupt, I mean it has severed the bond of trust between the American people and their elected officials, because hardly any Americans believe that members of Congress are more responsive to their constituents than they are to their donors. And this flood of money is being accompanied by a decline in transparency. So it's a double negative effect. Billions of dollars are going in that can't be traced, that aren't being reported.
So campaign finance reform is what you're saying would make a big difference.
Absolutely. Well, begin specifically with repeal or a future Supreme Court reversing the decision in Citizens United, which I believe will go down in American history as one of the worst decisions ever made by any Supreme Court in all of American history. So that's the first step. The other, I think, is a change in redistricting to try to reduce some degree of the hyper-partisanship that has now infected the process of redistricting. You know, every 10 years we change the congressional lines.
Right.
They've now been written so that of the 435 members of Congress, less than 50 run in competitive districts as between the parties. I can tell you right now which party is going to win about 385 of the seats in the next election, although we don't in some cases know who the individuals will be. There's some hope there, just as the court's decision in Citizens United was terribly wrong. It made the right decision just in June when they decided on a redistricting case based in Arizona that the states could have hopefully nonpartisan public entities who engage in redistricting and try to drain some of the politics out of it. Those two steps would go a long way.
Let me ask you about the Middle East, because you were the special envoy to the Middle East for President Obama. And today, now many years after he took office, and of course, each president has tried to do something for peace in the Middle East, but there's no sign of that at all. In fact, you could say we're further away from it than we were when President Obama started.
Well, you could say that about everybody who's been involved in the Middle East. 12 presidents, 20 secretary of states, innumerable envoys like myself. And the factors go far beyond just the United States and its position. Our specific mission was to try to resolve disputes primarily between Israelis and the Palestinians, and at the time, Israel and Syria. The turbulence in the Middle East is far broader than that and derives from historical factors that existed long before the United States existed. You can go all the way back to the time of the Prophet Muhammad and the split between Sunni and Shia, which was not a religious dispute but a political dispute as to which faction would succeed him upon his death. That has waxed and waned over the centuries. It's now at a high intensity of conflict. You can see it in Iraq and Syria and Yemen and many other places. So the situation, that the turbulence that exists, the rise of al-Qaeda, the rise of ISIS, those aren't related to the United States directly. Those are historical conflicts that have gone on for 1,400 years.
And you think those are stopping progress on peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
They're having an effect, obviously. I wouldn't say stopping progress, but they clearly have an effect, because the tendency of anyone in the middle of a hurricane is to hunker down and wait till the storm passes and then see what you can do. My own view is that both Israel and the Palestinians would be far better off with an agreement to compose their differences than they are now, precisely because of the turbulence and the turbulence that has created. Well, look, in Israel, there's a very high priority now, political priority from the government of Israel in maintaining its relationship with Egypt and Jordan, although they're subject to stresses, but those are key to Israel's foreign policy objectives. And I think the same would be true if they had an agreement with the Palestinians. And it would enable the countries of the region who are adversely affected by Iran's drive for control in the region to present a united front. Just look right now, the central objective in foreign policy of both the government of Israel and the government of Saudi Arabia is in resisting Iran. And yet there's not a bit of cooperation between them, two people in the same region with exactly the same foreign policy fears and objectives, and they don't cooperate at all. They should be doing so, because that's the real threat.
Having been out there in the world representing the United States, how do you think the world in general perceives the U.S.?
I think there is broad, widespread recognition that the United States is the dominant power, and that the United States represents freedom and opportunity around the world. There is, of course, disappointment when we don't agree with them. While I served as envoy, I was twice in the region. I met with the leaders of almost all of the countries, more than two dozen countries. And in the course of these discussions, they all complain about American policy. And whenever I asked them, what do you think American policy should be, their answer was a policy that was very good for their countries. In other words, they want the United States to take actions that are favorable to them. And who's to blame them? We, on the other hand, should be taking actions that are favorable to our society and our position and our future. Now, when you are the dominant power, there is inevitably a sense of anger when you do something they don't agree with. There is always importuning and trying to get the United States to take their side, trying to get the United States to fight their battles. So I think what we have to do, however, most importantly, is remain true to our ideals, because people recognize that, imperfect as our society is, this is a country based on the rule of law. This is a country which we aspire to opportunity for all, even though we don't reach that aspiration all of the time. So people truly do like America. I tell a story when I travel in the Middle East that Americans watching on television, and CNN shows up with a camera, and what they see is a bunch of guys burning an American flag. Well, if an American official from the local embassy or consulate came by and said to this group of guys, hey, I've got some visas here for America, anybody interested? They'd all drop the gas cans, they'd drop the flags, they'd run and grab the visas. But what concerns them, and what I've repeatedly encountered as I travel in that part of the world and in other parts of the world, is what they see as the contradictions between our stated ideals and our actions.
Senator Mitchell, I have one more question for you, and that involves the state where you're joining us from right now, the state that you represented in the Senate, and that is Maine, which is such an interesting state politically, because it's a state where you have you had at one point two women senators representing the state, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. You have Angus King, who's an independent, serving along with Susan Collins. The state tends to go for Democrats in presidential elections these days. And yet you have a very conservative governor in Paul LePage. What is it about politics in Maine that just you can't put it into a box?
Well, I have to say, of course, I'm not objective. I was born and raised in Maine. I've been so fortunate. My parents had no education. We grew up in very difficult circumstances, but I've been given opportunity after opportunity. I think this is the greatest place in the country and the best place in the world. So I love it, and I'll be very defensive about it. But it's open politics. Maine has a very competitive politics. Everybody can make their case. It's a small state in terms of numbers of people, so there's a lot of personal contact. I traveled every town in Maine. I spoke at the graduation of every single high school in Maine. So I don't think you can categorize it. In the specific case you mentioned, of course, the governor has never won a majority of the vote. One of the things about our election process is easy to get on the ballot for independents, and we rarely have just two people on the ballot. In the last election, we had three. The governor did prevail. He got, I think, in the high 40s, less than 50%. The election before, he got less than 40%. So it's personal. People expect to see, talk to, question, and get answers from their representatives. I think it's as good as you can get in democracy, and it's very, very competitive.
George Mitchell, former senator from Maine and envoy to the Middle East. His memoir is called Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life. Senator Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.